Today, the latest from New Zealand. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one latest post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian and New Zealand flavour. And today I'm joined again by Joe Wilkes. Hi Joe.
Hi Martin, how are you?
So, how is it over there? I gather it's quite cold. Certainly cold over here at the moment.
That's bloody ridiculous, mate. We've got houses over here that you wake up in the morning, you have to open the windows to warm them up. So, I was thinking about putting the fire on this morning, but yeah, no, it's been a little bit parky.
Well, I wonder whether that's something to do with global warming or whether it's just a local phenomenon. I guess we'll find out. Certainly up in the Northern Hemisphere, they've had a lot of very hot weather recently, so something's going on with the climate.
Nothing to do with global changes in climate, hey?
Anyhow, let's get started. And I think let's start with the latest data on the property sector in New Zealand, because there's been quite a lot going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Well, we posted on our last post the change in where the price bandings of purchases were taking place, and we put a fairly interesting chart that ran back from 2006 and just showed how we had this major switch in the prices going up, but also the sheer volumes of transactions taking place in the middle and upper bands, the 700 to 900 band. So gradually being replaced by a 9 to 1.2 band and 1.2 to 1.5 band. And it's really starting to present itself now in the Auckland market, because I'll say Auckland market, it's nationally, because we are seeing transaction volumes drop off quite rapidly. Just to give you an idea on the May data that REINZ published recently, you've seen a national drop-off in transactions from 7,876 sales in the May of 2018 to 7,263 transactions nationally. So the fall in national transactions is 7.8%, which is quite significant. The things that really stand out from the sales figures, though, and going back to that chart, you can see how very heavily reliant New Zealand and Auckland in particular have got on the upper end market, and that you know, churn of cash at the top end, the foreign buyers coming in. And Auckland sales in May were their worst that they have been. In fact, they've dropped off a cliff. 1,925 transactions in May, down from 2,462 last May. That's a drop of 21.8%. So the numbers are telling us something quite significant is happening. Now, yesterday, the RBNZ released their C31 data, which is the new lending data into the market. And we've talked about this before, because the numbers just don't make sense to me. You've got, 25,000 odd loans that have been written in New Zealand, just under $6.5 billion in new lending. So the new lending is still quite significant, but it has dropped off. So May's new lending compared to May of last year was actually 1.8% down. But this is a time when nationally you've got transactions down 7.8% in May. So people are borrowing a lot more. The average loan size, and I'll talk about loan size again in a minute, but the average loan size for the first-time buyer, so they borrowed the most that they've ever borrowed last month, $1.15 billion out of a share of just under $6.5 billion. They represent 17.8% of the total mortgages written. Now, first-time buyers, and this is where there's a cloud on the data, so we don't know how it's broken down between remortgages, refinance, how many people are using the house as an ATM still, and where the trading's happening up and down the market. But 25,000 loans against 7,263 transactions would suggest that there's a lot of refinancing going on. It would also suggest that possibly when you look at the first-time buyer side, because the first-time buyers have borrowed, total loans was 2,760. So when you split that against the number of transactions nationally, 7,263, you've got the first-time buyers with 17.8% of the mortgage money somehow, and this is not the reality, buying 38% of the property that's transacting. So the RBNZ still, or whether it's the banks reclassifying how they are showing loans being reported to the RBNZ, there is a mismatch in the actual data there.
So first-time buyers, it's interesting, in Australia we had a lot of data that demonstrated that in fact the measurement of first-time buyers was incorrect. So for example, a lot of the banks were reporting first-time buyers only those who were using the incentive scheme. So they were understating the number of first-time buyers in the system, firstly. And secondly, they also were looking at the number of loans, not the number of mortgages. So, of course, if first-time buyers split between interest and principal or fixed and variable, then effectively the loan size was actually being misrepresented relative to the overall mortgage. So quite often what we saw in Australia was the understating of the number of first-time buyers and an understating of the actual size of the loan being written, which, of course, what I mean by that is the total mortgage. Now, it'd be interesting to see whether there's the same thing as going on in New Zealand.
I started doing some work on the Wellington market as well, because Wellington was late into its bull run. So Auckland had its 2013, 14, 15, 16, really sort of went haywire. Wellington was a little bit slower than that. And the boom didn't really start until 2015. But it's a very similar pattern emerging. And I hope to have a graph for our next report where we can actually show how, again, the prevalence of money going into the top end, the bigger mortgages, so bigger loans that have been taken on. So the first time buyers taking on bigger loans, everybody taking on bigger loans to get into these middle brackets. And from early indication, exactly the same thing's happening. You're getting a drop off at the top end where the transactions are declining quite rapidly. So in Auckland, above 2 million sales are 43% down for the first 5 months of the year. The 1.2 to 2 million sales are down 28%. And I think that we're going to see something fairly similar with Wellington, but also the numbers of transactions taking place relative to previous years in those upper ends. So it's all being propped up at the moment by the first-time buyers borrowing a load to, I suppose, get the lower quartile houses. What maybe they don't realise is that there's so much weakness in the middle and upper ends of the market that they may be best placed to just wait and just see if there's a better house further down the track so they can move into, and hopefully a house where they don't have to open the windows to warm it up in the morning.
Yep, that's very interesting. Now, one of the things that, of course, came out this last week was the IMF report, which basically said that New Zealand were facing some challenges, particularly around high household debt and also because of their high dependency on the Australian banks. But they did say that potentially migration might well help to alleviate the issues. I don't know what you think about that, but I thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah, well, it's the same thing that we've seen in the Western world as well. It's how do you deal with the debt crisis? Right, you put more pressure on resources and you import more people. No different to what we saw in the UK. Flats where in 2005 and 2006, there were two people living in a two-bedroom flat in London. That was four people by 2015-16, because we just needed more bodies, more income to support high necessary rents to cover things. So we're going to see that. I mean, they're talking in New Zealand now about shared, I don't know how to describe it. It's like almost like halls of residence for late 20-year-olds where you go and cohabit. So you get a room which is, in some instances, is 100 square feet. I do it all in old money. But you get a bedroom and then you get access to a living room and then a kitchen, and you might have 20 or 30-something-year-olds all living in there. Now, don't get me wrong, I enjoyed my time at university. It was great fun. I spent 3 years doing a little bit of work and making some great relationships. We got thoroughly pissed very often. I don't know if I really fancy doing that in my late 20s when you're trying to develop a career. And you know, because in a cohabiting thing, you're always going to get 30 people. There'll always be some troublemaker who wants to go out of an evening and come back drunk. It's just the way it goes. So there's lots of pushing towards these types of developments now. And you can see the stress in the Auckland market, where there is concentrations of families living in the rental properties, where you've got three generations. A lot of them are recent arrivals. So you've got mum and dad. I mean, I was living in a different house about 12 months ago, and over the road from us, we had two families living in the house, so two brothers and both their wives. There were three children between them living in a four-bedroom house. And Nana and Granddad had come over, and they'd had the garage converted into their own little studio unit. It was a rented property, but that was the way that they could cover the rent and earn the crap wages to support living here. For a landlord's perspective, probably doesn't care as long as the rent's being paid. So we've got some issues, and that's the UK model all over again. Now, places like Spain and Ireland, and I've had some interesting discussions recently because of the DFA stuff. I'm getting contacts with a lot of guys who they are Irish, and they came over here 10 years ago, basically said, we're going to write Ireland off. There's no point being here. We're going to go to Australia. We're going to go to New Zealand. And these guys are New Zealand based, and they're in their late 20s, early 30s. Fortunately for many of them, they were able to get a life started 8, 9, 10 years ago, and two or three of them have bought houses. But it's really interesting listening to them and what they say about the similarities, and they're talking about how the fact that if they were doing it today, they wouldn't be coming to New Zealand. Now, this is a challenge because when you look at places like Spain, Spain had its debt bubble, very low government debt to GDP, high private debt. Bubble burst in the property market. Part of that was because they were building too much for us Poms who were buying holiday homes. And then you see this growth in government debt, collapse in the private sector economy, and everybody, not everybody, but an awful lot of Spaniards between the age of 18 and 28, 30 left. Many of them are now living in the overcrowded flats in London, where at least they can go and get a job. So, but it's devastated the real productive growth of the Spanish economy, and they are now forever tied to the ECB and whatever handouts the central bank decides to let them have. And that's the same in Greece, it's the same in other places. Does New Zealand have enough if we have this debt issue burst, which I worry about? Does it have enough to support the aspirations of a young generation competing with people who are coming in from abroad? Who, you know, if you're moving from Sri Lanka or India or a Chinese ghost town to New Zealand, yeah, it looks like a wonderful option, but because it's all relative. But does that change the way that the New Zealand economy looks in 5 years, 10 years time? I read an article the other day about, you know, what does the face of Auckland look like in 20 years' time? Don't know. I'm not sure whether they're talking about the job makeup or the migration makeup. So we've got to think about these things, because very quickly you can have challenges within democracy, because you've got so many different people that you've got to try and cater for, and you can never form a proper policy that's good for the whole country. We'll see. But the debt side of things, and particularly when you speak to the Irish guys who came over here 10 years ago, they say, you know, they're quite open. They say, look, there's no way we'd be getting into this today if it was a case of, right, we've just arrived on got off the plane 10 years, you know, today compared to where I was 10 years ago. So things are building. The debt levels, mortgage side, getting bigger and bigger for the first time buyers who I don't think really understand how weak the middle and upper end of the market. They're not being told. And there's this constant panic about you've got to get in, and it's very, very emotive.
Hi, it's Liz Interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show.
We had a little bit of banking scandal with the departure of CEO David Hisco at ANZ recently, and that was quite. It's all about the expenses. There's been bits that have come up since we spoke about a house purchase that was made by ANZ for Mr. Hisco in 2011 when he came over. When he came over from Australia, they stored the wine for him. Not a problem. That's probably to avoid import duties. But they stored the wine in Australia. The house was purchased and then sold at a loss after refurbishment in 2017 to Mr. Hisco's wife. Now at the time, we've seen this great big price rise. And there was a refurbishment that took place in that interim period, which ANZ paid for. Now, the three directors of the subsidiary business that ANZ had purchased his house in, one of those is actually a is the new CEO of Ayrton, or the acting CEO. So I don't, you know, that was a scandal, and it's sort of been dusted down this week. But what has happened since our last conversation is that we have now had the finance minister, Grant Robertson, present with Jacinda Ardern that New Zealand will introduce depositor insurance and protection. The sums being discussed between $30,000 and $50,000 protection. Now, it's very early days. It's something that they're saying, well, we'll get it in place by next year. Now, is this because there are bigger issues that are coming to the surface in the banking sector? It seems bizarre, having not had a depositor insurance for the last 8 years, that we should have one now, just as these murky things are coming back. So I think that there is a bigger story there. Now, the sum they're talking about, 30,000 to 50,000, is very small, but they say that it will protect 90% of New Zealand depositors. So just shows, really, in my view, that there is a lack of a buffer in the event of a challenge in the economy. A lot of people don't have massive deposits if families are, you know, only having liquidity up to about 50,000. So we know that anyway from negative savings rates and low KiwiSaver funds, average of 19,000 in KiwiSaver. So those things are obviously a worry to the government. I found it really bizarre because the shadow finance minister, Amy Adams, now she's been involved in the National Party for a number of years. She was part of the previous administration and did actually run for the leadership when it was contested after Bill English stepped down. Now, she didn't get the main job. She got the finance minister job. She was very, very vociferous in comments about the fact that the depositor bail-in guarantee wasn't enough and it needed to be more to protect people with more savings. And I don't know whether somebody spoke to her overnight, but the following day she decided to tender her resignation. So I'm not sure whether people said, well, actually, Amy, there's a bigger problem here. You might not want the finance minister job if that's get in next time. So there's all sorts of strange things. I didn't understand how you could be so vocal against something that your party got rid of 8 years ago in 2011 after the GFC challenges were deemed to have subsided. And then the following day resign. It was just strange. Anyway, but I'm going to question it. It's strange when this press haven't done.
Okay, and of course, on the deposit insurance, the rate set in New Zealand is quite a lot lower relative to some other countries. And you might wonder why that might be.
Well, I've got some thoughts on that, Martin. And if you look at the low depositor balance, in the UK, it's £85,000 per person within a household. So if you have a husband and wife, it's £85,000 per person. Now, the low balance is actually quite clever, I think, from Mr. Orr. And I'm going to say this because I see it as a way of trying to reduce the dependence on the big four Australian banks. Because if you are a depositor with significant amounts of money, then it would make sense to take your guarantees in as many places as you can. And therefore, if you've got $1 million sat in an ANZ bank account or a Westpac account, I've mentioned a couple, so I don't want to show favoritism or bury ANZ today. But what you probably look to do is say, okay, right, I need to spread the risk. There are 10 banks in New Zealand. Let's look at the cooperative. Let's look at Heartland. Let's go and spread our risk profile. And you'd probably do the same for, you know, both parties within a relationship. So it's a very, very sensible way of actually spreading the risk around the banking system. If we are raising the core one capital requirements, which I believe should happen, it has to happen in my opinion, because I think we are too susceptible to the risks that are building in the Australian economy. Then what it does is it provides a bit of a buffer for alternative banks to compete in the lending market, because they'll have a naturally better deposit base. I'm not sure if that's how you see it, but that's pretty much how I would see it.
Yeah, I think that might make sense. Just sort of comparison, the insurance rate in Australia, deposit insurance rate, $250,000. But of course, the arrangement here in Australia is that it's there on the sidelines until the government activates it. Now, when the government does activate it, it will be in a gone situation. And the banks here have not paid any levy, whereas in New Zealand, you're actually potentially going to pay a levy from the start. And that begs the question, will that change the deposit rates. So effectively, if the banks have to pay a levy from day one, build up a bit of a fund, I guess, for bailing out a bank later, that's one thing. But they may well take deposit rates low. And certainly here in Australia, we've seen deposit rates go through the floor. It's pretty dramatic, and many people are really struggling with the low deposit rates at the moment. That's quite interesting. I guess the New Zealand situation will develop, and we'll see how the deposit insurance plays out.
Yeah, well, we, you know, the first 5 months of this year, and we talk about the credit growth that goes like that, when it flatlines, that's a challenge to the housing market. The credit growth for me, the thing that I think should be highlighted above all else is that we're seeing a flatlining of credit growth. So it's not really growing at a faster rate than it was last year. It's not massively falling. I mean, May was one of 2 months of five this year where credit growth was lower than the corresponding month last year. But the sales volumes are significantly down. They are significantly down. So we have got more debt concentration being taken. So these last people who are getting into this, because I can't see anything other than you know, real challenging couple of years ahead. But these people are the ones that are exposing themselves to the greatest degree. And some balance needs to be out there in the media, just so that, you know, the kids understand what's really going on.
Okay, so what about the other markets? What's going on there?
No, well, and you look at this from a top end perspective, because there will still be older people in the market approaching retirement 10 years to go, thinking, okay, well, my house price hasn't gone down, because the house price indices don't show you the reality. But you've got to think, if you are a plus $2 million seller today in New Zealand, in Auckland, your chances of selling are they're significantly lower. They're 43% fewer transactions over 2 million. So you've done that on the basis that you've not been told that actually it's really hard to sell now. Your plan was to refinance, buy an investment property, or maybe even a holiday home, whatever it is. You've done that. 2 years down the line, you're stuck with this thing that you can't shift and you're having to reduce. So I think it's very similar to what you see with some of the major businesses out there. It's that the raising of debt to pay dividends, it's always almost the same. So there's a lot of firms at the moment, they're borrowing money in the markets just to satisfy the dividend payments. And actually, that's you can't carry that on forever.
Yeah, well, I've always felt that people are being cajoled into the market. You know, all the media is saying buy, 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 you know, buy now. It's very clearly here now. Prices have dropped a bit, so buy now. But of course, there are a whole set of risks in the market. And frankly, quite often, I suspect those risks are not fully understood, unfortunately.
Yeah, indeed, Martin.
Well, Joe, I appreciate your time today. Thank you very much for spending time with us. And we'll catch up again down the track.
Thanks for that. I'm going to put the fire up.
See ya.
Take care.